We'll call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but I would imagine in 4 more minutes we will. But we can get started and welcome Social Control Agency. And you have been given your very thick packet on very shiny paper. And so if you want to get introduce yourself and get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Leo Rodice, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And with me today is Lyle Mueller, who is the Finance Manager for the agency. We do appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about our budget today because we think it's a good opportunity to discuss what's ahead of us in the next couple of years, talk about the outcomes we've been able to achieve over the last few years, and have a good conversation about where we think environmental protection is going forward. Just to provide you an overview of where we're or how we're going to structure the presentation, is first I'll talk just briefly about the MPCA's mission and a little bit about our strategic plan, which is the framework for the way that we direct the activities of our programs and how we try to target specific outcomes. I'll talk briefly about the structure of the agency and how we actually do the work on the ground. And then we'll head into the programmatic areas of the agency and really try to highlight as much as possible the outcomes that we're achieving from the various programmatic activities that we do. The MPCA's mission, quite simply, is to work with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. The mission expanded a little bit in the last couple of years as we combined with the former Office of Environmental Assistance, and that's why you see the word conserve in our mission. Quite a bit of the work that the Office of Environmental Assistance did and now does as part of the new MPCA has to do with things such as energy conservation, resource conservation, and it's broadened the perspective of the agency, I think, since that change has occurred. Now, just a little bit about our strategic plan. We have had a strategic plan going back quite a number of years, but we revised this plan in recent years to try to really be more outcome-focused. And we think that we've made some progress. We, of course, have much progress yet to make, but we think it's a fairly decent plan that helps us understand where it is that we need to go and allows us to measure our performance. It includes specific vision statements on specific environmental areas such as air quality protection, water quality protection, land protection. And we also have very measurable goals and objectives. And again, we use these to target our activities to the greatest extent possible, and many of them are environmental outcomes focused, which is really what we're all about. A little bit about governance and partnerships, and I guess maybe I'll just highlight the things that make us somewhat different from other agencies in state government. The first one, of course, is our Citizens Board. We have a Citizens Board that essentially sets policy and direction for the agency and is very, very involved in most of the, if not all, the controversial issues that are brought before the agency. And this is in the form of environmental reviews and permits. We, of course, are able to issue permits and do environmental reviews without bringing them before the board when they're non-controversial. But typically, if there's an issue that's controversial and we need to make some sort of a regulatory decision, it's not uncommon for that to go to the board. It is a 9-member board. The MPCA commissioner serves as chair of the board, and the other 8 members consist of citizens from all walks of life. There are some dedicated seats, one for agriculture, and there is one dedicated seat for organized labor. And the members are appointed by the governor, and they serve staggered 4-year terms. We also have a very close working relationship with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Most of the work that we do and most of the statutory authorities that we have really flow from the major authorizing environmental statutes at the federal level. And those are things such as the federal Superfund law, the Clean Water Act, and the Clean Air Act. We operate a number of environmental programs in coordination with the EPA. They have delegated us certain authorities that we exercise in the course of our daily business to protect the air and water quality and to clean up contaminated sites. We do have a very close working relationship with them because we are delegated, but also because we receive some grant funding from the EPA, and they have some fairly high expectations for the work that we do. We also have some very close relationships with other state agencies, such as the Department of Natural Resources, Minnesota Department of Health, Board of Water and Soil Resources, and others. We also operate on a partnership basis with many other organizations throughout the state, counties, watershed groups, soil and water conservation districts. All three of those groups of bodies are very, very key to us in delivering our services and getting the outcomes that we would like to see on dealing with issues such as solid waste management, recycling, water quality protection and improvement. And finally, we do have some advisory groups that provide us with advice on how to address certain issues, whether it's having to do with environmental education or trying to find innovative ways to achieve better environmental outcomes through the work that we do. Just a brief few words about our organization and structure. We have roughly 800 staff located throughout the state in 8 regional offices. And the staff that are located throughout the state work in a variety of divisions. We have 7 divisions that are focused on the kinds of communities that we work with or regulate. And you can see them listed on the slide. The industrial division is the area of the agency that is focused primarily on regulation of larger and medium-sized industrial facilities who have to comply with air quality, water quality, and hazardous waste regulations. The regional division, that's the division that actually operates the regional offices, but is also where we deliver most of the watershed work that we are funded to do. Our TMDL program is managed out of the regional division, as is our feedlot program. The municipal division is a very, very key division in the sense that we work very closely with cities and townships to ensure that wastewater and stormwater is properly managed. This includes work in technical assistance, permitting, compliance enforcement, and rule development. The Prevention and Assistance Division is where most of the folks from the previous Office of Environmental Assistance have landed. This is a division where we do the large majority of our work in pollution prevention, environmental education, and technical and financial assistance on prevention activities. The Remediation Division is the division that houses the people that do our cleanup work. And these are the folks that are actively engaged on issues such as the 3M contamination issues on the East Metropolitan in the East Metropolitan area. This is also the division that responds to spills and emergencies when they do occur. The Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division is, I guess, the best way to describe it is it's our R&D function at the agency, and this is where we do monitoring and assessment of the physical and environmental and biological conditions in the environment, and we also do standard setting out of this group. And finally, the Operational Support Division. This is really the backbone of the agency where we do our financial and human resource services and support the work of the other six divisions. Excuse me.
Excuse me. We're going to take questions as we go. It just makes it easier for folks. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I have a question regarding, I just kind of looking at where your offices are located, and I'm wondering, there's the northern section now. How do you go? I mean, do you have regular patterns and times that you go to visit, for instance, Rainy River and check on pollution up there as it comes out of the paper plant? Because I get lots of stories from up there. I grew up up there. So I get a lot of stories from people that live there about the effluent that's still going in Rainy River. I don't see an office there. How do you serve that area, and do you have any comments about that particular area?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have the staff in our regional offices cover, especially in the northwestern and north central part of the state, a pretty broad swath of the state. We do have staff that regularly inspect facilities for issues such as effluent problems or violations. Facilities are required to issue regular discharge monitoring reports that let us know what's going into the water. I don't know specifically what may be happening currently on the Rainy River. We do also do the monitoring and assessment work just of the ambient condition of the waters of our state, and I'd be happy to provide more information about that specific water body at a later time if that would work, or we could find somebody to come in and talk about that.
Thank you. I think that that would be helpful. I'm just kind of curious about that. The paper plant in International Falls, and as it flows through and goes into Lake of the Woods, I hear lots of horror stories about what's in that river, and I'm just kind of curious what your role is in that and if you're aware of that situation, and I would like some information on that.
Well, I think what we'll do is after we've been through the presentation and as you get questions at the very end and you want to come back, we'll do those questions at the very in our last hearing day with you. So the committee gets an opportunity to also hear the response.
Okay, on to the next slide. Now I'll start talking about the budget from an agency-wide perspective. And first, I guess what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the relationship between the environmental and remediation funds, which provide most of the funding for the agency. The remediation fund, as you can see, is about 23% of our budget, at least in the governor's recommended budget for the upcoming biennium. Most of those dollars flow from the environmental fund. We receive an appropriation into the environmental fund, and the receipts to the environmental fund are actually $173.8 million. There is a portion of that that is transferred into the remediation fund based upon what we believe the project needs are in our remediation programs in the next couple of years. So just keep that in mind as we talk about these various fund areas and how they work to support the work of the agency. The Environmental Fund is the largest source of funding for the agency at about 40%, and most of this is broken down as follows. We receive funding through the solid waste tax, which is 55% of our fund receipts. We also receive the motor vehicle title transfer fee, which is 14% of the receipts. And then we receive a variety of fees from generators of hazardous waste, people who need to get air quality permits and stormwater and water quality permits, and that's around $43 million for the biennium. As far as receipts...
If you could just stop there and just so folks get an understanding, 55% of this money, so about what comes from solid waste? Of the money in the environmental fund from the solid waste tax. What's the dollar amount?
Madam Chair, the dollar amount is $95.3
million. We have a question here from Representative Dill.
How much of the $93 million, Madam Chair, is returned to the counties?
Madam Chair, Representative, currently the budget, I believe, is $12.5 million per year in SCORE funding. As you'll see later in the proposal, we have an initiative to increase the SCORE to $14 million.
So a lot of the funding from the agency comes from the solid waste tax. How much of it is applied to reduce solid waste? How much of it is actually spent on all of the programs relating to solid waste?
Madam Chair, I actually will be getting that in a couple of slides. Would you like to jump to that now? Or?
Nope. We can. Okay. Glad to wait, but let's do that. So I do have one other question about the environmental fund. You get in there money from water and air permits. Do these permits pay their whole cost? I mean, in other words, when somebody asks for a permit and pays money into this fund, does the cost, or does the fee they pay for the permit cover the cost of your work?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it does not. The way to think about the fees that we collect for regulated parties, it really breaks down into two different categories. One category are the fees that we assess for construction activity. In other words, building new facilities or putting in new developments in brownfields, things of that sort. The other category of fees is what we call our operating fees. So once a facility is up and running, they pay a certain fee based upon how much they emit. And I'll break that down specifically as to how that actually works in dollar terms. On the construction permitting side, the only fees that we really have to assess folks who are doing construction are stormwater construction fees, and there's a water quality permit application fee. It's a fairly small amount. The large bulk of our fees actually comes in from water quality fees on municipal wastewater treatment plants, and they have flow-based fees based upon how large they are. And those fees can range from around $1,000 or so dollars for a very small plant to well over $100,000 for the metro plant. We also charge fairly significant fees for air quality pollution sources. And we are required to do this by the Federal Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act requires states to collect sufficient fees to operate the operating permit program. The distinction here, again, is between operating permits and construction permits. So where we do not collect sufficient fees to fund our activities is in the construction side. So when a facility comes in and needs to go through the environmental review process or receive a permit from the agency, say an air quality and water quality permit, we do not collect fees, by and large, to cover those service costs.
If you could, when you come back, because I noticed it wasn't in here, give us a breakdown of that grouping of fees and how much they pay for the services and how much they do not. This is a question we've been asking as we've been through DNR also, and in DNR, there's some permits that permittees pay the whole cost and some permits where they pay very little. And there doesn't seem to be any rational basis to distinguish those. So I know that the air quality you must do by federal law. So let's just, if we could see the breakdown and how much of total cost is paid for. Okay?
And I'm sure I can actually give you a breakdown of what the fees are at this point, and then perhaps we can give a...
In writing, so we can just see it, so we can look at it, and people have a chance to look at it beforehand. Representative Dill has a question.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius. Do you review EAWs as well, environmental assessment work fees?
Madam Chair, Representative, we do. There are two different kinds of work that we do on environmental assessment worksheets. One is commenting on environmental assessment worksheets that are done by other responsible governmental units. So where, say, the DNR is an RGU or some local authority is an RGU and we have an environmental issue that we want to comment on, we do that. The most intensive work that we do is where we actually are the responsible governmental unit. A good example of that is in ethanol. When an ethanol plant is proposed to be built in part of the state, we not only issue the water quality and air quality permits, but we also do the environmental review. In mining, we are not the RGUs, so we work in partnership with DNR to make sure that as they do the environmental review, our issues are fully considered. We are the permitting authority, but we're not the RGU. We do approximately 30 EAWs per year. That bounces up and down a little bit, maybe 2 to 3 EISs. We do not receive fees to do the EAWs. Those are funded out of the general fund. For EISs, the people who are actually proposing the facility that needs to go through an EIS, they are required to pay for the cost of that process.
Could you, when you bring back the information that Chair Wagenius requested, could you estimate what kind of time you spend on EAWs and what's your internal chargeback rate on EISs when you do the reviews, like an hourly charge, something like that? Thank you.
Good question. Any other questions around this issue? Okay, if you go ahead.
Okay. To move on to the remediation fund, the remediation fund is about 23% of the funding for the agency. $56.9 million is transferred in from the environmental fund. And again, these are biennial figures. We also receive a transfer from Petro Fund, which is managed by the Department of Commerce, and that's the amount of $17.2 million. And then we have a variety of smaller, dedicated, and non-dedicated receipts, things like the dry cleaner fees, the revenues generated by the land program, and we also receive some investment income. We also have a segment of the budget that's described as miscellaneous special revenue, and this, the largest portion of this, 17% of it, is the agency's indirect costs. And this is where, if you recall the work that I described in the operational support division, this is the human resources and fiscal services function, really the backbone operations of the agency. This is also the portion of the budget where we fund activities such as EISs, so as we get payments in from proposers, we do that out of this fund. Now, just to give you a picture of what the agency's budget has looked like over time, going back to the beginning of the century, the agency has seen a slowly declining level of appropriation in the last four biennia. As you can see, the governor's recommended budget is actually showing an increase, and the primary reason for that is that we are proposing an increase in general fund for the agency to fund activities that would be focused on the Clean Water Legacy Act, as well as a couple of initiatives that deal with renewable energy and permitting of facilities. The current governor's recommended budget shows that 15% of our funding would come from the general fund. The last time we've seen a 15% share of general fund was back in fiscal year 2000 and 2001. Now, just to briefly give you a different slice of our budget, since we'll be talking about programs, the appropriations that I just described, when we talk about the environmental and the remediation fund, really doesn't give you a sense of how we spend the money on our environmental priorities. So, Madam Chair, this gets to your earlier question about how much we spend on solid waste activities. The water program is the largest share of our budget. 33% of our staff are found in this area, and most of the agency's priority programs fall in this area. And of the general fund appropriations of the PCA, 80% of them are spent on water quality. And the land program, it's very, very large compared to the level of staffing in our agency, because this is where we do our remediation work. A lot of these dollars are spent on cleanups of historic contaminated sites, which can be very, very expensive to clean up. I have a couple of examples later that I'll be discussing, but it's not unusual to have a cleanup project that ranges from $50 to $70 to $80 million to do the work. The air program is a smaller percentage of our budget. However, we do have some high priority activities in this area. Primarily, this is work that, as I mentioned earlier, is regulation of facilities such as ethanol plants, mining facilities, and we also do some non-regulatory work on renewable energy out of this programmatic area. The multimedia program is an aggregation of work that integrates across the agency and across the environmental media. We pay for activities such as data collection and analysis out of this area. We also pay for environmental assessments and and review out of this area. The work that we do on the Mercury Reduction Initiative comes out of this area, as does standard setting. Environmental assistance is where most of the work that used to be done out of the Office of Environmental Assistance, that's where the funding comes out of this area. And again, administrative support, which I discussed earlier. And now I'll segue into talking about the agency's priorities, and then we'll flow into specific discussions on the programmatic areas. And we will be starting off with land, where we'll discuss how much of the budget is spent on solid waste activities. But before I headed into the programmatic areas, I wanted to outline the agency's priorities to give you a sense of how we focus the work that we do and how we look at our strategic plan in terms of focusing on the outcomes that we wish to achieve. The priorities really fall in two major areas. The first major area, I have a number of bullets there, but it's a grouping of programs that we call our core environmental programs. And these are activities that really form the foundation of the agency's work and is work that we have done since the agency's inception in 1967. It's permitting and compliance and enforcement. This is a standard regulatory activity that we do for things such as solid waste facilities, air quality sources, water quality treatment plants, both municipal and industrial. Monitoring and assessment is also a very, very key and foundational aspect of the agency's work, and this is where we do the assessment of the ambient conditions in the state so that we understand what is happening out there, where the problems are, and where the successes are. Cleanup and emergency response is also a key area for the agency. It's an area of significant controversy, as we've all seen in the issues with the 3M contaminated sites in the East Metro area. And then environmental assistance, which is the core programmatic area that was formerly done at the Office of Environmental Assistance, and is a very, very important part of what we do, and is focused primarily on prevention. The second major priority area for us is impaired waters. And we are fortunate in that we now have a Clean Water Legacy Act that provides us very clear policy direction on how we need to address the impairments that we're seeing across the state in our water bodies. We estimate that roughly 40% of the water in the state, streams and lakes, are impaired, don't meet water quality standards that we have in the state. We have focused a lot of our energies and activities in impaired waters, and it's going to be a focus for us for years to come. And we do have some pressures on our priorities, and some of the initiatives that we'll be talking about later are meant to address some of these pressures. And I'd just like to highlight a few of them to give you a sense of what the policy landscape is shaping up to be for the agency. We have been subject to an intense amount of litigation in recent years, primarily focused on impaired waters and the stormwater program. The most notable example of this is the Maple Lake Annandale case, which, for those members that recall, it's a wastewater treatment plant that was supposed to be permitted, is proposed to be permitted, and the permit that the agency issued has been challenged to court. It's currently before the Minnesota Supreme Court. We have yet to receive a decision from the court, but until they decide on this case, we are unable to issue permits for 60 new or expanding facilities across the state. We expect that decision is going to come down fairly soon, but I've been saying that for the last 3 months, so I'm hopeful that we'll get that resolved quickly so that we can actually resolve some unsettled policy issues.
To clarify for the committee, the reason you can't issue those permits is because people want to put additional pollution into the water body. And if they had asked for a permit to do less, that wouldn't have been a problem. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's part of the answer. And I'm by no means a legal expert on the case, but the broad outlines of the issue are thus. Lake Pepin is impaired for nutrients, and the watershed for Lake Pepin covers about two-thirds of the state, which is surprising to some folks. In fact, we have a mining facility that's proposed up on the Iron Range that is just at the edge of the Lake Pepin watershed. Because they are in the Lake Pepin watershed, they cannot increase their cost for loading that watershed, and they've chosen to pursue a zero-discharge option. The issue before the Supreme Court is if a facility is going to create an increased discharge into the watershed, what we were challenged on was whether or not we could implement a trading system so that if you had decreases in one area, you can offset increases in another area within the same watershed so that the overall pollution loading is down. The reason the answer isn't as clear as you had stated it is in this particular case, there is a treatment plant that's being replaced that actually discharges more, but because they're going to a new wastewater facility, it's considered a new source, and it's therefore considered a new discharge. We think that actually the result of this permit would be less discharge to the water body, but that's an issue for the court to resolve, and we'll wait to see what they have to say on it.
I think one of the additional issues is also that the offset that was considered was fairly opportunistic. It wasn't an agreement made between two groups, and somebody just said, well, geez, they reduced, so I get to increase. It wasn't that those two groups got together and said, well, hey, if you reduce, I can increase, and I'll help you pay to reduce, which is our normal offset way of operating. So if you want to go on.
The second issue that we've seen some litigation on has to do with stormwater. We're in a new era of stormwater regulation, not only in the state but across the country. EPA promulgated rules that they call their Phase 2 Stormwater Permitting Program. We have had a stormwater program in place since the early 1990s where we've issued permits to industrial facilities, construction sites that were over 5 acres, and also to two municipalities, the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. The recent changes in the federal law have tightened up the requirements considerably, and one of the areas in which we're seeing a lot more permitting activity is in our municipal stormwater permitting program. We were challenged in court on the way we issued that permit, and we were challenged on the fact that there was not sufficient public review of permits that we were to issue for the municipalities. As a consequence of losing that lawsuit, there is quite a bit more work that the agency needs to do to review the plans in these permits. There are 230 permits in all, and to do public notice on all those permits. So it's just to give you a flavor of how some of these decisions are increasing the workload at the agency. The second issue that I'd like to discuss in terms of priorities is the increase that in workload that we're seeing from specific industry sectors and the fact that we have a growing economy in general. The two areas in particular that are placing quite significant strains on our resources are the ethanol and mining industries. We have 23 ethanol facilities that we're aware of that are in various stages of development. We have a number of those in-house and working on environmental reviews and permits. Ethanol plants typically need air quality and water quality permits as well as environmental review. And while the plants themselves tend to be more similar these days in terms of the way they're constructed and operated, there are site-specific issues that can be quite significantly different. And these usually are related to water quality issues. So it's quite a significant resource demand on the agency. We're also seeing some significant economic development in the northern half of the state in the mining industry, and we have 8 plants that we are either reviewing or anticipate moving permits in the coming months and years, and this is also placing quite a strain on our resources.
Help me out here. When we were talking to DNR, we were told that folks who apply for mining permits pay the full cost of the permitting, but for ethanol, they do not. For you, neither one pay the full cost?
Madam Chair, again, the answer is a little complicated. In terms of the construction permitting, they do not. There's a very, very small, I believe it's, actually the figures right in front of me here. Actually, I'll find that before we complete here, but it's in the hundreds of dollars for the construction permitting fees. The operating fees that these facilities pay can be quite significant. And for the mining industry, once they're up and operating and they're paying their emissions fees as a result of having permits, they are in the top tier, in the top 10 facilities, thank you, that pay fees at the agency. The earlier statement that I made about the small amount of construction fees, what a typical facility will pay, such as a mining or an ethanol facility, just for construction permit application fees is $750. It doesn't come close to covering the cost of the work that we do. But again, once the facilities are operating, in particular in mining, they pay a very significant share of our air quality budget.
But ethanol would not.
Madam Chair, it depends again on the facility. If they are able to reduce their emissions, and we're finding that ethanol plants are getting cleaner and cleaner, if they emit less, they pay less.
Representative Dill has a question.
As I recall, the air permits, let's just pick on one company, Mintec, U.S. Steel Mintec. I mean, that's in the millions, right?
Madam Chair,
million or more.
Don't have that particular facility. We could probably get that in relatively short order. It's a significant amount.
Cool. When you do the review of the construction, the construction part of the permitting process, could you tell us when you bring back further information that we've already requested, the amount of time that you spend on those different types of categories, and again what your internal chargeback rate is on that, so we can kind of get a clearer picture of what the real cost of doing that is, that activity. Understand that?
Madam Chair, Representative, as far as the chargeback rate, we can do that with environmental impact statements, because we actually do charge for those services. For permitting work, we don't actually have a chargeback rate, but we can share with you the percent of time that we spend on those various industrial sectors so you can get a picture of that.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Mull.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just along that same lines, I don't know if you can estimate this or not, but Representative Wagenius asked how much does the agency pay our collect for permitting for ethanol plants. It seems to me that regardless, we kind of subsidize that permit process somewhat as a state of Minnesota. Maybe could you give us an idea what percent perhaps is paid for by tax dollars and what percent you might actually collect from the permittee? And if you can't even estimate, I guess that would be something we'd like to have too.
You could bring that back when you bring the rest of the questions back. We can do that all at once. Is that all right, Representative Mo? Yes, and Representative Hill has another question.
Well, I was just wondering if you could also provide to us what it costs the agency to defend itself on lawsuits that are brought against these different environmental, for example, the Maple Lake Annandale case, maybe others that are brought forward that I can't cite specifically at the moment, but just to get a general feel on how that gets paid for, where that gets paid for in your pie chart.
Madam Chair, Representative, we could certainly break down the cost related to our legal activities. What will be difficult, probably impossible to characterize, is the bigger impact on us is sort of the lost opportunity cost. When we have legal challenges, it tends to slow down our processes and we take more time to issue our permits that are not subject to that specific challenge. So there are, we can get you certainly the cost that we spend on defending ourselves in court, but I think that would just be a small slice of what it actually means for the agency. But we're happy to do that.
You want to go ahead?
Yeah, the last pressure on our priorities I'd like to talk about are just the new and anticipated pollution issues. The most notable example, again, is are the issues that we're facing in the eastern metropolitan area relating to historic 3M contamination. There are many, many chemicals that the EPA reviews on an annual basis. Each year, they estimate that they review about 1,700 new chemical compounds. Many, many more thousands have been approved for use, and our understanding of their toxicity and effect on the environment is not always all that great. But when we do get information about problems that these chemicals cause, they will result in changes in our programs, either in limits that we have to adjust in permits or revisiting old contamination sites to ensure that these compounds that we previously weren't aware of are being adequately addressed and so forth. This is an area that is growing fairly rapidly. There is increasing concern about things such as endocrine disruptors and what it is that we can do about that and how they work in the environment. And I expect that activity is only going to grow in coming years. Now to start off with the programmatic areas of the agency, and again to remind you of how we intend to discuss the specific programmatic areas, is what I'll do at the beginning is I'll lay out the vision that we have for that programmatic area, which is in our strategic plan, and then highlight a few key goals that we think of emphasize the priority work within that area of our strategic plan. As we do that, we'll also talk about some of the outcomes related to those goals and maybe highlight a few activities that that show you, to give you some sense of what it is we're able to accomplish in these programmatic areas. In the land program, our vision is quite simple. It's that Minnesota's land is it supports desired uses. And for us, that usually means that we are conserving those resources and preventing pollution so that we don't have contaminated land in the future, that we undertake activities that minimize the release of contaminants to or from the land. And this could be either through our prevention programs or through our regulatory programs. And then we also work to restore contaminated land to productive use. The other thing you're going to see as we walk through our budget is I'm going to flash up this org chart at the beginning of each budget segment so you get an understanding of where we do this work in the agency. What you see here is a very high-level organizational chart for the agency, which is the commissioner's office and our seven major divisions. And by the way, all the division directors for these divisions will be here at the hearings, are here today, so that as we have specific questions, as we move into this work, they're available to answer your questions. Back in 1998, we moved away from an organization where we had our air program in one division, our water program in one division, our land programs in two divisions. We decided to go to what's called a matrix organization so that we have these programmatic areas interspersed in different divisions. And the reason we do that is that we think it's a more effective way to deal with the complex issues that we see in the environment, which don't always break very cleanly along media lines. So for the land work, the majority of the work falls in three divisions at the agency. The industrial division, which is where we do regulation of industrial facilities. The municipal division, and in this case, it's mostly the oversight of municipal solid waste facilities. And then our remediation division, which really is the bulk of the land work that we do in terms of dollars, and is where we do the cleanup of historic contamination. This is a picture of what the land budget looks like. And I'll break it down so that you have an understanding of how much we spend on remediation and how much we spend on solid waste. The remediation fund accounts for 77% of the funding in this area, and it falls into essentially four major areas, and I also want to just give you a heads up on an initiative that we have in this fund. But the first area is the closed landfill program, and I'll be talking about that as we head into the outcomes discussions. But that is $34.3 million for the biennium. The second largest programmatic area is Superfund, which is $22 million. The third largest is the Petroleum Remediation Program at $17.2 million. And then we have our Voluntary Investigation and Cleanup Program, a portion of which is paid out of the Remediation Fund at $3.2 million. We also have a small amount of funding that comes from this fund to the Department of Health to do environmental health assessment work related to our remediation sites. That has been $400,000 for the biennium. We will be proposing an initiative. We are proposing an initiative to increase that by $52,000 per year, so that total is going to be $504,000 over the course of the biennium, should the governor's recommended budget prevail. In the environmental fund, this constitutes 15% of the funding for the land program. And here, back to your question about solid waste, this is where we fund our solid waste activities, and $8.7 million is directed at those activities. Hazardous waste
Okay, just if you could just slow down for a second. So you have $8.7 million goes to solid waste activities, yet solid waste raises $95.5 million. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct.
All right. I think that's just something for us to keep in mind as we understand this budgeting process.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, there's also the closed landfill program, which is... Okay.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Rod Manson from the Pollution Control Agency. I thought maybe it's a little more complicated than that. The solid waste money that Leo was talking about is $8.7 million. It's for the solid waste regulatory program. There's also $49 million, which you'll hear in a little bit, that goes to the environmental assistance. That also comes from the environmental fund and has traditionally been based on the solid waste tax. In addition, there's a $34 million for the solid waste closed landfill cleanup. So those areas are all traditionally funded by the solid waste tax and continue to be funded that way.
But not necessarily related to solid waste.
Well, Madam Chair, I would submit that the environmental assistance, the assistance to prevent itself, which is the old OEA, was funded by the solid waste tax and was thought to be related to solid waste because it covers a lot of recycling. The SCORE funding comes through there. The PAC, the grants that go to folks for reduction of solid waste and hazardous waste goes through there. So, yes, I think it is related to solid waste, as is the landfill cleanup program related to solid waste. So, yes, I think all three of those I cited are closely related to solid waste.
And they would add up to?
I didn't do the math in my head.
Madam Chair, we could provide that.
But we'll provide that.
That would be helpful. Yeah. Just break it down and provide it when you come back. That would be super. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on the closed landfill program or these remediation funds, I guess I have a specific question about the 3M disposable facilities in Washington County. And it's my understanding that at least one of those, there was an effort to go back and clean up solvents or et cetera. Was that paid for with public money from these remediation funds, that prior cleanup, or was that done by the company?
Madam Chair, Representative, I have to actually have a slide on this. Just a couple minutes, we'll be talking about the PFC's issues. The landfill I think you're referring to is the Washington County landfill, which is in the closed landfill program and is the state's responsibility. Okay. The last piece that I'll just briefly touch on is the federal portion of the land funding, and it breaks down as follows. We have a super fund. We have dollars that come in from the federal government in the amount of $2 million. We have our leaking underground storage tank program, which is funded at $2.7 million from the federal government. And we also receive dollars from the federal government to support our voluntary investigation and cleanup program in the amount of $1.4 million. One thing I like to say about the voluntary investigation and cleanup program is most of that is cost recovered from regulated parties who enter into the program. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Before I head into the meat of the discussion on land programs, I thought it might be useful to just give you a sense of the range of activities we do in the land programs and just give you a sense as to how I'm going to be talking about them. But first I'll be talking about the cleanup programs, which are in the sort of the top half of the list of programs that you see on the slide, and then moving to the management programs. And management really refers to our management of ongoing generation of solid waste and hazardous waste and how that ought to be managed appropriately. And then moving into the prevention and assistance areas. And when we get to prevention, we'll segue into the next portion of our programmatic work, which is environmental assistance, and we'll talk about the programs that Mr. Massey discussed that are related to solid waste. Now, getting back to the question about the perfluorinated chemical contamination in the East Metropolitan area, there's been a lot that's been happening on this issue in recent weeks, so I thought that we would take an opportunity just for a few minutes to let you know what has happened recently and perhaps address any questions you have about how this work is moving forward, who's paying for which work, and to be able to make sure that the committee has a good understanding of what's taking place. The most recent issue that we're facing in the East Metropolitan area is that last year we were finally able to detect a compound that had been produced by 3M that is called PFBA. Now, there's a variety of compounds that are considered perfluorinated chemicals that were manufactured by 3M and disposed of quite some time ago. In fact, many of these disposal sites that we're working on were created and were being filled with industrial waste well before the agency was even in existence. In many cases, records are poor, and figuring out where some of this waste has been deposited requires quite a bit of detective work. In the case of PFBA, we recently have gained the ability to detect this in groundwater, and we're finding levels of it in several communities, and in some communities it's at levels that we're concerned about. There were a number of public meetings that were held about a week ago, and I believe we have one more meeting still yet to go today, where the Department of Health is attempting to explain to the community that or what their health-based numbers mean, and then we also talked about some of the actions that are being taken with regard to the contamination. And I'll just briefly list off some of those actions that are taking place, and then if there are questions, we have folks here who can perhaps address some of those questions. But there are really four disposal sites that we are focusing on. And as I said earlier, the records of some of these disposal sites are not all that good. And we continue to get suggestions that there are other sites that we ought to investigate, and we do that. I think at this point we have about a dozen very small sites located in various portions of the state where people think that some of this waste may have been disposed of. We go out and check it out, and we make sure that the groundwater surrounding those sites is not contaminated or isn't any isn't a problem. That work will continue to go on as we get more information about potential disposal sites. But the bulk of our work is focused on these four sites that are affecting the communities of the East Metro area. The first one is a site in Oakdale, and there's been a significant amount of work that's been taking place on this site as a result of contamination from another perfluorinated compound, or excuse me, two compounds. And I apologize for the alphabet soup. I know this can get kind of confusing. It's certainly been confusing in the public meetings that we've had with the communities. But these other compounds called PFOS and PFOA are larger chain compounds and tend to stick around in the environment for longer, and we have greater concerns about their health impacts. We have directed 3M to provide us a report, which is due in about a month, for how they are going to address this new contamination that we're concerned about. Typically, the way the Superfund program works is when we have a responsible party, and on the Oakdale site, 3M is a responsible party, which means they are responsible for the cleanup costs. And it's not only their costs as far as the contractors that they pay to do the cleanup, but it also is the costs that the agency incurs to oversee their work, because we have an obligation and a responsibility to make sure that the work that is done by these contractors is actually going to get the job done and will clean up the environment. When they submit a proposal to us, we have the obligation and the authority to review those plans and to determine whether or not they're adequate. And typically what we'll get from a regulated party is their preferred option based upon what they think is the most cost-effective way to address the contamination. We don't always agree. And when we don't agree, we request they change their plan and perhaps take them in a different direction. So I think we'll have to wait and see what their plan is. We understand that they're considering a number of options. And when we review those, we will make our determinations appropriately. We think that the work on this site should start...
Just a second. You said the plan is due when? And when? Can you give us a date on that?
The plan is due in April, and we expect that the construction, the actual remediation, to begin this working season and probably last into next season.
If it's due... the plan coming from then, will that be public record immediately?
Madam Chair, I assume so. I don't see why not. We've made all the records that we can available on this issue.
Okay. So is it a squishy date in April, or is there a fixed date in April?
Madam Chair, it's April 2007. If there's a specific date, I can get back to you on the specific date.
If you would.
The second site, which the representative was referencing, was the Washington County Sanitary Landfill. And this landfill has been controlled for volatile organic compounds in the past, but now that we're aware of these PFCs, we are taking steps to ensure that that the issues and any contamination from this facility is being cleaned up and contained. Clean drinking water has been provided to some residents who are affected by this site, and currently we're experimenting with different resins to treat the pump out water from this site, so that the water that is pumped out does not contain undue levels of contamination of the compounds in question. We expect to make a decision finally on what the best technical solution is this spring. These are fairly complicated engineering issues that need to be looked at before we make major investments, and I think that from what I'm hearing from our staff is that we should be able to make a determination fairly soon. The Chemolite plant in Cottage Grove is also an industrial disposal site, and we recently issued a letter to 3M, I believe it was on February 2nd, if I'm not mistaken, that directs them to undertake a number of activities to address the contamination that is happening off of that facility. We are also expecting a report from them in April, and we expect that the implementation on the fixes ought to begin this season and next. One of the things that we are doing at this facility in particular is looking into the air quality issues, which has not been looked at in the past, and the Commissioner and I have directed staff to look at what the potential for air deposition of these compounds may be from the site. And that includes both doing monitoring of the facility in question, but also doing modeling to understand maybe what the deposition patterns are in the area so that we have a really good understanding of what the situation might be. And finally, the Woodbury disposal site, which is also in the Superfund program. The 3M company has committed to doing the follow-up actions, and the investigation is happening this working season. The timing of the remediation, we think, is going to happen this working season, but we're still unclear as to exactly what steps they're going to take. But we expect that is going to be completed sometime next working season. In addition to the work on remediation, we have and continue to undertake...
We have a question. Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, earlier you referenced the term record-keeping. I assume that applies to the company. Could you talk to us a little bit about requirements for records and the look-back period? And I got to tell you, that sounds a little bit squishy to me.
Madam Chair, Representative Ansel, the records are very poor. If you recall, the disposal of these wastes goes back to the middle part of last century, before most of the environmental laws were passed. So in some cases, this requires us to try to seek out former employees who may have knowledge of the disposal. It's not uncommon in dealing with these old Superfund sites, whether it's 3M or the old reserve mining site or any other sites, that the records back in those days before there were major environmental laws in place just were not that great. Currently, facilities are required to do extensive record keeping on where they dispose of waste and how they're appropriately managed. They're also disposed of in lined landfills. The waste that was disposed of in this case and in many other cases was in unlined landfills. We would not allow that today. And as a result, there are many issues that are a result of really not great management from years back.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be appropriate to talk about another Superfund project at this time?
I know which one you want to talk about. And why don't we just finish the PFOAs, PFOSs, and then we'll talk about that. Is that
great,
right?
Thank you. Yeah.
And I think that is appropriate, and yes, we will do it. Okay. We have two questions here, Representative Gardner and then Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. On the issue of PFCs and leaking landfills, one of the major methods of dealing with it is what's called in the statutes removal, essentially pumping out the water. Where's that water going, and what's happening to it? Does anyone have any idea of whether we're just moving it from one place to another? And I see you've got wastewater treatment effects listed there. Just because we pump it out doesn't necessarily mean that we get rid of it. And I guess I'd like to see what we know and don't know about what happens to that material after we pump it out.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll give you a general answer, and then I'll look to our Mediation Division Director to perhaps give us a little bit more thorough answer. And if we can't answer the question thoroughly, we'll get back to you with the very specific information. But my understanding is that the water that is pumped out is treated, and that could mean being sent to a wastewater treatment plant to treat, or is treated on site through the use of filters or resins. Again, in the Washington County landfill, we're experimenting with some rather state-of-the-art resins to be able to remove things like PFBA, which we didn't even know about previously and didn't really have an understanding how to treat. If there's anything additional that... That's correct. So that's an overview, but if you, Representative, if you'd like a specific listing of how we're treating the pump-out water from these facilities, we'd be happy to provide that.
Just as a follow-up, Representative Boyanis, I guess we're concerned about our wastewater capacity and other things like that, and we're just adding to the stresses of that by having to pump it out. I know that's what we have to do, but it's just integrated into a lot of other things, and I just wanted to be clear about that. I also wanted to just notice one thing. I pulled out the statute on 115B.17 on state responses to releases, and there's somebody used the word mushy or squishy, and I couldn't help but think of it, but the legislature wrote this, so I'm not giving you a hard time, but we say when we have a threatened release of a hazardous substance, the agency may take removal or remedial action. The agency may do one thing or another. I'd just be curious what your reaction would be on the use of the word shall for taking remedial action, finding information, and so on.
Madam Chair, Representative, I am not an expert on that statute. What I will tell you is that when we find levels that are that exceed the health-based values that are promulgated by the Department of Health, we require regulated parties to take actions and to address the problem and to remediate it and to make sure that clean drinking water is provided to communities that have waters in excess of those levels. With regard to wastewater treatment, and I was about to get into this issue of water quality criteria, we are also concerned about what happens with the water that ends up, the contamination that ends up in surface water. And our staff are actively developing what we call water quality criteria, which is what we do to set standards so that we make sure that what ends up in the surface water is not going to create a problem. We know that we already have a problem in the Mississippi River. We don't want to add to that, and we want to make sure that our wastewater treatment plants have good guidance on what is appropriate in terms of dealing with this problem waste.
As a practical matter, help me understand this. Some of the water from these pump-out treatments from the PFOAs, PFOSs, is going into the Pig's Eye wastewater treatment plant?
I'm sure that's correct.
Is that plant capable of taking those chemicals out?
Madam Chair, that's the issue that we have with not having water quality criteria. When we do have the criteria, that's going to guide the wastewater treatment plants on what levels of these compounds they need to be treating down to. The technology is behind where it needs to be.
So basically, we're just, as Representative Gardner said, we're just basically moving the water, pumping it out, moving it through the wastewater treatment system and putting it in the Mississippi River down a little bit further. So I guess what I need to understand is how much water is going into the Mississippi River now that is contaminated. I think I hear of four different waste streams. You haven't mentioned the Pig's Eye old landfill. We know that that is also leaking. So if we could get some sort of idea of volume of water that is going into the Mississippi that could contain, or no, contains one of these chemicals. Is that, am I articulating that right?
Okay. I'm sure I understand the question, and we'll get that information for you.
Okay, if you could. That would be helpful.
The last thing I wanted to say...
Wait a second.
Sorry.
We have a list. Representative Clark, then Hansen. I do have a list here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a number of questions. I know we have members on this committee who are new and weren't here when extensive hearings happened in the Senate around the issues of the PFCs, and I guess I think it might be important for those...
Representative Clark, could you speak a little bit more into your microphone?
Is that better?
Trouble hearing. Okay.
Is that better? Okay. I was just saying that I know we have new members on the committee who may not be familiar with some of the extensive testimony about PFCs that happened in the Senate, not here in the House, but it happened in the Senate, and I happened to attend a couple of those hearings in the Senate Environment Committee last year, and I believe even the year before. And I'm wondering, are you the person that I could ask questions about? Because one of the questions I'd like to know is, there was testimony there by a scientist who was one of your lead scientists until she was fired for reporting on the PFC problem. And I recall that she had asked that there be testing done in some of these areas, several of these different areas. And so when you say that you're just starting, or you just recently learned about these problems, can you take us back to the time when you would tell us that you first learned about these problems? And does it include the kind of request by that lead scientist to look at this several years ago?
And as part of the answer to that question, remind the committee which chemical this is so closely associated with that it alerted scientists that it had much of the same construction that this could have indeed have been, could be a very hazardous substance.
Madam Chair, Representative, on that question, it's getting beyond my level of technical expertise. I can talk about, and we can have somebody come up.
Someone up here must know which chemical it was. I'm beginning to think it was dioxin, but I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair,
nobody knows.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Sandusky. I'm Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division. And to start, as I think most of you know, the PFOS compounds were associated with Scotchgard. That's the product that's been in the news that related to this. 3M, and this isn't exactly, this is more remediation program activity, but the company voluntarily discontinued the production of Scotchgard in about 2000. This agency began its work related to the disposal sites, I believe, in around 2002. That work has continued, and we even began presence or reconnaissance work on the presence of these chemicals not related to the disposal sites in 2004. And I can talk about those, and that work is continuing. So the story I'm telling, in other words, is that not only has the agency focused on the presence and the containment and the protection efforts related to the known disposal sites, but much like some of the endocrine disrupting chemicals, we have begun and have been doing for a couple of years now reconnaissance work on the presence of these chemicals not related to, in the environment, in the ambient environment, not related to these disposal sites. We have sampled fish, we have sampled the water column, and we have sampled groundwater in several areas of the state.
Can I go back, and you are probably the one who will know, which chemical, there was a chemical that this was so closely related to in its construction that the scientists said, we better look
PCBs.
At it. PCBs, okay. I knew there was one and I just couldn't remember. Okay.
Madam Chair, PCBs, the chemical construction is similar, and that's important because that relates to its endurance, if you will, in the environment. Its half-life is very long. It is very difficult to break down in the environment.
Thank you for that. Representative Clark.
Well, I'm wondering if you would answer the question about when what your response was when Dr. Ollier's requests were to do the testing, and actually I believe she did actually take fish and have them sampled, and I think it was in February of last year, so over a year ago, in the Senate, there was testimony about the need for the very kind of testing that you're just now saying you're going to start doing, but it's been more than a year now. And, you know, as we, again, members here who are new may not know, but Dr. Freddie Noye was basically fired. There was a mediated settlement because she did bring these questions forward, and at the time we had a different commissioner. Had a commissioner who had previously worked at 3M and was very involved with this particular product when she was there and then became our new PCA commissioner. And under her leadership, I'm very concerned that what happened was a scientist who was there and brought this effort forward and talked about it in the Senate, and after she talked about it in the Senate, was forced to leave. And I'm wondering what you'd like to tell us about that, because we have, you know, we have known for a while now that this testing should have been done on many levels, including not only the landfills, but the air and, you know, the soil, and so now it's not really new information to us, and I think to portray it that way is perhaps a little ingenuous. I'd like to just hear what you can tell us about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I was at those hearings. Let me start with this. all of the recommendations that Dr. Oliai made to the committee or in papers that were provided to the committee were either being acted upon at the time of those hearings or have been acted upon since. So all the environmental partitions that she recommended for sampling, and many of them had already begun before those hearings, and as I've just referenced, in 2004 we began sampling fish, water column, and sediment. So if I go much further, I'm going to be beyond my professionalism here, but what I think I want to say is all the testimony in that hearing, not all of that testimony was accurate.
Well, Madam Chair, just one thing. When you talk about you were already doing it, I believe she was one of the people who was already doing it. That's correct. But I guess, you know, on behalf of at least some of the people who serve on my committee in the public health committee, there was questions raised there about, you know, when did y'all know what was going on, and why didn't the public know sooner? And then I guess one of the big questions I have is this whole issue of health-based values. And if I could just for a moment get you to talk about the kind of warnings that you have been working on with the health department and with 3M around understanding the health impacts of these TFCs. And we're talking about the whole family of them because, let me just ask you first to respond to that, and then I have a question.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, actually I'll need some help from somebody else. However, all of the work that is being done, whether it be related to monitoring at the disposal sites or monitoring in the ambient environment, which I've already referenced, all of that information is being provided to the Department of Health, among other agencies, for the express purpose of providing them with information that supports their effort to develop both health-based values as related to the drinking water situation with the disposal sites, and the fish consumption advisories. Already, some of the information that we've provided to the Department of Health has resulted in changes to the fish consumption advisory, specifically, I believe, related to bluegills. I believe that the work that we're currently doing and the data that we're going to be providing them with current sampling efforts will further enhance their understanding and potentially result in more fish consumption advisories. As it relates to the health-based values for drinking water and the disposal sites, I'd need somebody else to talk about that.
Madam Chair, I guess that would be good. And then also to, you know, when the fish were being tested again by Dr. Ole, and that information was actually presented by her, so let's give her credit for doing the work. I think there was a, you know, let me just ask you this question. Was there a suppression of this information by your agency?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, absolutely not.
Okay. So then you knew at that time that some of these levels were extremely high in the fish, for example.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, yes.
Well, I think one of the problems that people have raised is why wasn't the public alerted? You know, that these were very high. And one of the questions I do have is, my understanding, and we had some testimony again in the public health committee here, that the health-based values and the work done on whether or not there were any human impacts by exposure to these chemicals, there was no difference between 3M's lab findings and the Minnesota Department of Health. Everything was in sync. So when 3M said, you know, that we haven't had any impacts on our employees, the Minnesota Department of Health doesn't disagree with that. In fact, they cite it, and they did in the committee. But I have to tell you, I was visited by the 3M, the person who's the physician at 3M, and I don't know if he's here, but he spent quite a bit of time, he and several other people from 3M, because it was in response to the committee that I chair looking at this issue. And when we were talking about the question of whether or not there's special concerns for children or pregnant women, you know, whether or not the health-based values might be different for them than they would be for adults, he basically said, that's bogus, there's no difference. And when I heard that, I asked him to clarify it, and he just said, well, there's just no difference. We don't worry more. It's a dose-related issue. And I said, well, I thought we had learned recently, or not recently, many years ago, actually, that beyond the dose impact on someone, the developmental stage that a person is at, that a fetus is at, that a child is at, really does impact whether or not there's a health problem that occurs. And so the 3M scientist who is advising them and the public on whether or not there are impacts, health impacts, is basically saying he doesn't buy that kind of science. And so I'm wondering where you are with that. Where is our MPCA with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I have a couple of things to say here. Number one, my understanding, but you should really ask the Department of Health, is that they are actually mandated pursuant to statute to consider dose response, among other things, for the protection of children and developmental phases. So talk to them about that. So I understand that's part of their mandate, and I would expect them to be doing that in all of their standard and health advisory work. Secondly, because I know that Because I know that a lot of people are interested in the effects from these chemicals, some of the research scientists at the Pollution Control Agency and I know at the Department of Health have been searching literature to make useful definitive statements about effects of PFCs. And while we're further along in saying something meaningful than we were even 2 or 3 years ago, where there was very little information about exposure and effects. I'll give you an example of why things are still a little fuzzy. I asked Dr. Laura Solem on my staff straight ahead the question, are PFCs, for example, endocrine disrupting, do they have endocrine disrupting effects? The answer is, number one, none of these chemicals, any of the compounds that Commissioner Raudis mentioned, none of these have toxic reproductive effects. However, for developmental effects, there are a number of studies that are going on right now, not completed, that, for example, Dr. Solem knows about, that would point to their potential for effects in developmental stages. So while we're further along, clarity, definitive statements about effects is still not where we are today.
Madam Chair?
Representative Clark, could I just follow up?
Sure.
When you talked about developmental effects, would you just tell the committee what you mean by that? If you could.
Madam Chair, I separated my comments into two areas. I talked about reproductive effects. The reproductive system of mammals is what we're principally talking about because that's where the studies focus. And then I separated that from the development of both unborn and newborn small mammals. And so while it looks like the effects are not pronounced for PFCs, I'm talking about the PFC compounds, just to remind you, are not expressed in reproductive problems, the ability to reproduce, come to term, et cetera, there are a number of studies that are not concluded that do point to the potential for effects in the development of either unborn or newly born fetuses.
Are you then talking about like neurological effects as a development effect? I mean, I just...
That is beyond my expertise, Madam Chair.
I mean, that's when we talk about development effects, there are a number of categories, and it's just what is the effect on development would be helpful, and if you all could just let us know what that is, what those are that scientists are looking at, that would be helpful. I'm sorry, Representative Clark.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good clarification, too. So I wanted to ask you, and I don't know if you're not the right person to ask, but are you aware of 3M's position on this, on denying that there are developmental considerations in looking at PFCs?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, no, I am not. I know nothing about that part of the discussion that you just expressed.
I'm trying to wonder if there is anybody from 3M here.
I don't see anybody.
Is there anybody from 3M?
Madam Chair? This is really I thought it was an overview of the budget. I didn't know we were going to get involved in specific items. It may be better for a future hearing rather than just hitting people kind of willy-nilly on related issues.
Well, Representative Oshin, the agency did bring this issue up knowing that it was a lot of concern for a lot of folks, and so I think because they brought it up at this time, this is the correct time to flesh it out, and so people have a good understanding. We had that opportunity when we were dealing with DNR to look at some more issues in depth, and this is the time the agency chose, and I am willing to respect that. I am watching the time, and I see other folks that have questions. Representative Clark?
Madam Chair, I'll end it. I guess I would just maybe request Mr. Sandusky and whoever else would be the appropriate persons maybe to give me a written comment on the relationship between the work that our agency, our public pollution control agency, is doing and research on this, and your relationship or your agreements or disagreements with the 3M laboratory research that's being done, and maybe a comparison of that with the Department of Health, because it gets very murky when we hear from one state agency like the Department of Health that they totally, you know, that everything is in sync, they totally agree with 3M's laboratory findings, and then find out that there's a whole different kind of science going on. So I guess if you could just maybe write me a memo addressing that, I'd greatly appreciate it, and I'd be glad to share it with the rest of the community.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I believe I understand what you're requesting. Let me, and we will do our best to respond to that. May I respectfully suggest that, at least from my vantage point, the position about laboratory work, effects on infants and small children, the position of the state relative to 3M's position, all of that is mostly germane for the Department of Health to be commenting on as the state institution that provides the risk advice for the state, and also as the state agency that does the water laboratory work for the state, by and large.
There are a couple of other. Did you want to follow up on that?
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, it's part of the Pollution Control Agency is hopefully protecting us. That's part of what your mission is. And so, I mean, coordination with those agencies is really important. I think there is probably some improvement that can happen in the coordination, if that's some of what you're saying. But we rely on you to provide us with information. And I would guess, I would hope to. I think we just heard earlier that you believe that's part of your mission, so maybe it was a different speaker, if it was.
We have some other folks that have questions. I want to get through this set of questions before we leave. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be quick. I want to go back to the chemistry and as it relates to remediation. So PFOA and PFOS, are they the eight carbon chain, and then the PFBA is the four? So these molecules are persistent. You mentioned something about half-life. So this is the degradant. This is going to be it. It doesn't break down any further. Ultraviolet light, or, I mean, if we're in a groundwater condition, maybe in an anaerobic condition, it goes through wastewater treatment. This molecule doesn't break down. Is that what I hear you saying? Each of these three molecules do not break down.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is beyond my expertise as well. We can get you a response to that.
If you would do that, that would be helpful. Representative McNamara, you are on the next list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to qualify for the members that the 3M Chemolite plant is in my district, shared with Representative Bingham. I happen to have three uncles that raised their family with a working career at 3M Chemolite plant. So I know how good of a neighbor they've been to our community. I also know they did a number of manufacturing practices in the 60s, 70s, And throughout that time, that today we look back and think of the way that stuff was disposed of. Oh my goodness, what in the world were we doing? One of those places they chose to dispose was just about maybe 500 yards upstream of where I spent about 20 years working with a shallow well. So I very much live in this. I will say to the folks here, they have been a terrific corporate citizen of our community in light of all of that. They have spent, I believe, tens of millions of dollars in Oakdale and Lake Elmo to do cleanup about some very troubling chemicals. This new one looks on the surface to be somewhat better. Unfortunately, we don't know enough about it. I think Representative Garner made a great point. The MPCA, in statute, may deal with this in a matter differently than they have so far, and it's my hope that we can continue to push in a direction. But I have a number of questions. I think Representative Osmond's point that this probably isn't really the totally appropriate way, because we're bombing. I snuck up in the audience to ask some questions. There's an MPCA employee that's done a great job of presentations at the public meetings, and he's not here to answer some questions that I think are appropriate. One of them talked about where this wastewater is going. I believe from one of the facilities, the wastewater is going through the 3M plant. Some of it is being filtered for through carbon filters. I believe some of it is also going in a retention pond. So before we go down too far, I think we got to make sure we have the right people in the committee here to answer the questions. Mr. Stein from the Department of Health has been fantastic. What I would tell you, MPCA, you're going to go to a public meeting tonight in South St. Paul. Don't spend an hour giving them background information about the whole world. All they want to know is, what can they do today? How scared should they be if they got young children and they're nursing them, or they got pets they're worried about? And would they be better to melt the snow, or should they let them drink? That's the kind of questions they have. Unfortunately, folks, we don't have the answers today that we wish we had. I think there's some sort of short-term solutions that we need to think about doing in the interim. And I have had discussions with Commissioner Moore specifically about this, and it's my hope. I will say, Representative Clark, as far as them moving in sync, they're not moving in sync. They're moving in sync in the science of what some of what we have found. We have split samples. 3M has tested them. The Department of Health has tested them. Thank goodness. A lot of the results, or the results they're coming up with, say the same thing. I'd be very troubled if they weren't saying the same thing. I don't think the Department of Health and MPCA are on the same page as 3M. I know I'm not on the same page as 3M. As much as we like them, I would argue they could sell a couple more sheets of sandpaper or a couple more post-it notes and do some things that would be a lot better for the families in our area. So I've probably gone on and on enough. I'm trying to think, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure when we come back, if it's in Representative Clark's committee where we've already heard it, or in this committee, this is very important. This is very important. They've been a fantastic employer. Honestly, I had an uncle retire in his early 50s from a career at 3M working there, and has enjoyed. He's 80-some years old today and is living a great life based on that. Raised 10 kids, as a matter of fact, in his family. His wife never worked that whole time. It's a fantastic company. They've done great things. But we expect them to really step up here for mistakes that were made from decades ago. So I appreciate what the departments are doing, but we are going to hold your feet to the fire and expect you to do it. And if you don't, we are going to go into the blue book. Used to be green, Representative Gardner. I almost called it green. And we may change some maize to shells if that's what the need is. I'd rather keep them a may, but I just want you to push them as hard as you can. And we may make some of these, all these guys have been in my office with these fancy titles, Government Affairs Manager for 3M. His business card is a post-it note. What a great idea. I wonder how much they made off that idea. We can take some of that money and do some things. So I've gone on long enough, Madam Chair, but I do hope we bring them back. But I think it's fair that we properly prepare them. And if 3M is in the audience, I'm glad they didn't come down, because I would have interrupted right away. It wouldn't have been fair for us to chastise them, because they need to bring their correct people here, too, for it.
Okay, then, given what you have said, Representative McNamara, I think that the way we're going to proceed here, and Representative Clark, is that we will, when we come back on our next hearing, we will start with the Superfund program, and then we have Representative Moes at the top of the list on the questions there.
And we will go through all of your presentation and your budget, and then we will deal with the questions that have been asked along the line that you all didn't have answers to now, which is fine. That's what these hearings are about. But it's at that hearing that we will revisit this issue. If that is all right with members, is that acceptable to members? Okay, that's the procedure we'll follow. And I'm looking at the clock, and with that, we did have a quorum, so I will note that for the record, and the meeting is adjourned.